My name is Helen Doe. I have a doctorate in history from the University of Exeter. So I'm a historian and lecturer, mainly in the field of maritime history. I'm often asked why I'm a maritime historian, and it goes straight back to my mother's Cornish family. We spent every sheltered holiday down in Polruan in Cornwall, and small community of mariners and shipbuilders, and my family have for centuries been mariners and shipbuilders there. So growing up, this was a really important place for us. My father was in the Air Force, so we kept moving. So this was the one constant. And being part of the sea, being on the sea, and therefore the lifeboat was absolutely essential. You understood how important it was to these small coastal communities. And that was just something you grew up with. I was I've been incredibly privileged to be asked to write the history, the official history of the RNLI for its bicentenary. And that is an enormous and at times daunting task because there is so much to put in. It's not what you can get in, it's what you have to leave out. And the more you get into it, the more you get into the correspondence and minutes. But also the thing that struck me immensely is somebody's asking, what are you doing at the moment? And I say, what I'm doing. And everyone has a story about the RNLI. Almost everyone I speak to, casual acquaintance, close friends, whoever, has a story about the RNLI and how important it is. Had a very interesting discussion just recently with someone who wants to interview me for something quite different. And I just got talking about it and I explained what I was doing and what my book at the moment. And he said, well, my great grandfather was a crew member. And it turned out his grandfather gained a silver medal from the RNLI. But the interesting part about him is that he was also a very effective poacher. He was brought up before the local magistrate several times for poaching, but he was also the local coxswain of the lifeboat. What I've been trying to do is I've been trying to look at the bits that haven't been covered before, and there are masses of publications about the RNLI. Some wonderful publications about its total history, but also about local branches, about the bravery of the men and the women. And so I've been trying to look at some of the characters who really haven't been described before. And particularly in the very early days, Sir William Hillary gets mentioned a great deal, quite rightly. But there was a whole group of other men, mainly men, who were very, very important to that initial founding. So William Hillary's in the Isle of Man. He can't organise it. So he's dependent on these people in London, headed by Thomas Wilson, an MP. But you've also got someone called Simon Cock that nobody seems to have ever mentioned before, who is absolutely vital to the very, very first meeting. He's secretary to the shipping interest there. He's secretary to the London docks. And he is the first person that really helps to organise things and get it going. Sadly, he dies in 1837, which is probably why he's kind of been lost in the RNLI's history. Throughout the work that I've been doing, and I've been obviously covering a lot of, a very big period in time, what Sir William Hillary said in his first appeal about a national organisation, an organisation funded by as a charity, run and with the crewmen as volunteers, all of these threads have come through very strongly. The question of whether it should be a national organisation, a government-funded organisation, has come up several times in its history. But it's always gone back to the fact that strength lies in its volunteer and charity status, and that it's so rooted in the local communities in which it's based. The other thing that I find as a total thread and a really important thread is the fact that no judgments are made. Right from the beginning, as far as Sir William Hillary and everyone else was concerned, it wasn't about who you rescued. It was that someone needed rescuing, regardless of where they came from. Like any organisations, it's had ups and downs. Right from the beginning, because you're starting from scratch to organise something on a national basis, they had a lot of very early support financially. But then that died away. And through the 1830s and 40s, really the whole organisation fell into the doldrums. 1850-1852 brought a whole new energy, new people, new ideas, and it pushed it forward. But every so often, and again, I think in the 1970s, it had challenges. In the late 19th century, it was challenged to the extent that a select committee, parliamentary select committee, investigated it at some length. So it's always had times when it's been challenged for all sorts of reasons. And I think some of the more recent challenges would have been the COVID era. I mean, that challenged everybody. But imagine trying to manage such a massive organisation when suddenly everything is shut down. That is one heck of a challenge. Sir Gerald du Maurier, exceedingly well-known actor of his time, in 1926, he and his wife decided they wanted to have a holiday home in Cornwall. And they found a beautiful property in Badinic, in the harbour of Foy. He bought a boat. His daughter, wonderful writer Daphne du Maurier, later said that it wasn't a particularly practical boat for the area. But he bought this boat and he employed a retired naval man called Adams, Harry Adams, to be his boatman and to look after the boat for him. And Harry Adams was my grandfather. Now, the first summer that the family, the du Maurier family, were there, Gerald du Maurier decided to go out with this boat, and he was going to go from Foy to Polperro. And he took Harry Adams with him, sensibly. And the engine failed, and they nearly went on the rocks. And Gerald du Maurier told his daughter about it, but swore her to secrecy. But it's quite interesting that the very next year, in one of the first years of the official BBC, there is a fundraising section. It's called Cause of the Week, where the RNLI has this wonderful duologue that is a dramatised situation where there's somebody, retired water hero, in a cottage in Cornwall and his wife, and they hear the Maroons go off. And then this little duologue about, you know, the RNLI going out and how important it is and how to raise money. And you can see the echoes in that. You wonder whether Gerald's little near accident on the rocks outside Polperro induced him to suggest this to the RNLI or where the idea came from. But it certainly was the very first radio appeal by the RNLI. Right from the very early days, I remember my mother talking about the RNLI, and when we were down on holiday in Cornwall, in those days you would hear the Maroons go off, and so everybody rushed to see what was going on and to watch the lifeboat going out. And so the RNLI was always sort of in the background there, part of it. You'd see the lifeboat, you might know some of the crew. And of course, with Cornwall as well, the great tragedies of things like the Penlee really affects you very deeply. But doing the book now, writing this book, has brought me a deeper and wider appreciation of the RNLI, an understanding the sheer breadth and depth of the commitment of so many people, which is so impressive. And I've had the great joy in meeting many more crew members and people who are fundraisers and people who are just touched by the RNLI one way or another. And it has been a great privilege, it really has, and I am enjoying every moment of it. There is emotional moments where you think about the sad losses, but also there are some amusing stories and just the incredible commitment of so many people. It's a very great privilege.
Hello, it's Sir Ben Ainslie here. You've been listening to part of the RNLI's 200 Voices collection. To hear more remarkable stories, head to rnli.org/200voices. Or subscribe to the RNLI wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you.
Two Hundred Voices is an Adventurous Audio Limited production for the RNLI.